Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the International Relations Forum, and your chair of today's program, which is entitled Investing in Girls, Hope or Hype, with Dr. Wanjiru Kamu-Ruttenberg. You know, the idea of increasing education for girls who are represented in classrooms, underrepresented in classrooms around the world, by the way, by a significant margin, is an idea that's caught on fire the last decade or two, along with a broader idea of empowering women and around the world to bring social change and equity. And to that end, in the last decade, the UN created a special body called UN Women, which is working towards empowering women. We developed, as a community in the world, the Millennium Development Goals, which includes a specific goal about educating girls to reach parity with boys and empowering women. This is something we're doing as a global community. It's even talked about when we justified military actions in Afghanistan, the bringing parity in education for girls. So it's been on the topic. It's been discussed in this room, actually, to some degree. But the question is, how do we know whether or not we're having the impact we have? How do we know we're achieving these goals? How do we know that we're doing the things we needed to be successful? And that's where Dr. Wanjiru Kamu-Ruttenberg comes in. She's the a leader of a group called the Akili Dada, which you can see on the screen here. And she's here tonight to share her ideas and her lessons learned on making substantial, sustainable investments in the lives of vulnerable girls in Africa. A huge task. And she's going to tell us what she's learned from that experience. And rather than steal her thunder, I'm going to read her bio. I usually like to encapsulate bios in a couple of bullets, but there's a couple of kind of impressive things in here that she and her organization have achieved, and I want you to get it right, because there's significant things here. Professor Wanjiru Kamu-Ruttenberg is founder and executive director of Akili Dada, an award-winning leadership incubator investing in high-achieving young African women from underprivileged backgrounds. She is an assistant professor in politics department at the University of San Francisco, where research and teaching interests center on the politics of philanthropy, gender, Africa, and ethnicity. Originally from Africa, she's passionate about the synergy between rigorous academic analysis and committed social activism. And she's received widespread recognition for her work with Akili Dada, including being honored very recently, at the White House as a champion of change. She's a winner of the 2010 UN Marketplace of Peace competition, recipient of the 2011 Yamashita Prize and the 2011 African Achievers International Award and the 2012 Howe Fund Fellowship. And I could go on and on, but let's hear directly from Wanjiru about your experiences. Please welcome Wanjiru.
Hello, everybody. I am beyond excited to be here and really, really nervous too. I talk a lot, and so people have a hard time believing that I get nervous, but I do get nervous, and I am nervous. But I'm really excited about this topic, and I'm really excited to get the opportunity to speak about with you about something that I care deeply, deeply about and that I've been engaged in for a while. I'm going to do this in two ways, just because I'm an academic and an activist, so I split things a lot. I straddle fences a lot, so I'm going to straddle this one as well. I'm going to do something more scripted, which is sharing my work with Akili Dada and what we're doing. And then I'm going to go off script and really get to talk about some of the things that I think are really interesting about the field and some of the things that we wrestle with or that keep me up at night. Okay, so and then we're gonna do a Q&A because some of my best spouting off happens when I really go off script. So I'm gonna try and make sure we do some of that. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you, Paul and Linda, who is in the room. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share about our work and to get to make new friends and engage in what I hope will be a really rigorous conversation. As Paul mentioned, my name is Wanjiro Kamau Rutenberg, and I'm the founder and executive director of Akili Dada. Akili Dada is 7 years old, and we are a leadership incubator that is investing in the next generation of African women leaders. I'm standing here because I really want to be somewhere over there, but I also want to do the recording, so... I teach, and I do this. I come right to the middle of the room because I really want to be here and talking with you. So, excuse me. So that's Akili Dada. This is one of my favorite pictures of some of the work that we do because I feel it really captures the essence of the organization, the essence of the mission that we have, which is to take young women, like the scholar with a ponytail, she's one of our scholars, to take young women and surround them with the support, the encouragement, the enthusiasm, the nurturing that they need to excel and to get really, really good at whatever they're meant to be when they grow up. So I just love starting this talk with that picture because I feel it really captures what we're about. It's about creating a network of support for young women. What does Akili Dada do? Akili Dada invests in high potential, brilliant adolescent girls from underprivileged families who are passionate about social change. So that's, if I had to tell you in one sentence what we do, that's what we do. We offer comprehensive high school scholarships to some of the brightest girls from the poorest families across Kenya. We have a personalized mentoring program where we pair up our scholars one-to-one with professional Kenyan women who volunteer their time to serve as mentors. We then also have a very rigorous leadership training curriculum that is experiential, that is based on service. And that comes out of our vision of what leadership is about. We have a very unique vision of leadership, which is a servant leadership model. We believe you're a good, effective, efficient leader, not if you can stand on top of a pyramid and tell people what to do, but if you can work together with people collaboratively to achieve shared goals. And that belief of what leadership looks like influences the type of programming that we do and has deeply shaped our leadership training curriculum. Without the investments that Akili Dada makes in these young women, these future leaders would actually drop out of school and for financial reasons be forced to enter into either early marriage, the low-wage workforce, or really have very limited life options. And so that's a big element of what we're doing also, and that's important to us. What are the fundamental beliefs that underlie our work? We believe that this is an issue of justice. We believe that justice is served when there's a diversity of voices at the decision-making table. Specifically, we believe that policies and lives around the world would improve if women, and especially women from poor backgrounds, had access to decision-making policies, processes. Let me give you an example. If you have a meeting at the Ministry of Water in whatever government, and you have women there who grew up walking 20 miles to go fetch water, and they have access to the decisions that are made at that ministry, the policies coming out of that ministry are going to look very different. So that's some of the philosophies that underline what we believe, why we do what we do. We believe that education, mentoring, and leadership training are critical to poor women's access to leadership positions, right? And so finally, leadership is not accidental. You don't just wake up and, oops, I'm in decision making. We believe that leadership must be nurtured and it must be grown with intention and purpose. People don't end up in leadership by accident. There's a journey you can take and there's training. You can learn to be a leader, an effective, good leader. So these are some of the values that underline what we do. This is what we believe. So the challenge. This is usually the easiest part of my presentation. African women are severely underrepresented in decision making across the continent and around the world. I could do a quick test right now. Let's come up with a list of 10 African women in leadership that you know. Yes. Ellen Sullen Johnston. Joyce Banda. Wangari Maathai. Oh, don't stop at 3. Nima Boy. The lady at the ICC. Oh, Fatu, yes, that's Fatu, that's her name. We're up to 5. We've got a problem. Right? You get my point, right? We have got a problem when... Ngozi, yes. Nigerian woman. 6. Yeah, Wangari Maathai. Yeah. 6. See, if I was doing the voice editing, I'd do the cricket sound. Okay, right, like my point is easily made. We've got a problem, right? Like we need more African women in decision making. This is a global problem. The world is missing out a lot by not having those voices in decision making. This is a loss that we should care about, that we should be concerned with. If you look at one element of leadership, and again, I mentioned we have a very broad vision and understanding of what leadership is. If you look at one element of leadership, African women are 17% of legislators across Africa. That's the average. Now, not to pick on y'all, but what are American women? Yeah, so women in leadership is a global problem. Sorry, just had to throw that in there. Okay, I'm from Kenya. Akili Dada runs in Kenya, and we've got particularly big problems in Kenya where women are only 0.5% of the top leadership in government, 1% of the heads of state corporations, and 10% of parliament, right? Rwanda being at 51-52% has really boosted the African average. Like we that 17% is thanks to Rwanda. Yeah, there's quotas, I believe. Yeah. So the Akili Dada model. How are we addressing this challenge? I mentioned that we have scholarships. What I want to share with you now is some of the details of why we're successful, right? This is why our program works. We offer scholarships that are comprehensive and cover everything from school fees to personal hygiene products to PTA fees. When we take on a young woman, she never has to worry about money for school. That burden is lifted. And she can now focus on what she's there to do, which is to be in school. And that has turned out to be absolutely crucial. Because there's a lot of scholarship programs where you have to reapply every year. So you're in school, but you're worried about, will I be here next year? Will I be here next week? We take care of that. When we give a scholarship, it is guaranteed for all 4 years. It's yours to lose. And that's a very strong message to send to a young woman from a financially underprivileged background who's had to struggle for resources all her life. It's a huge message to say, you don't have to worry about money for school. Go ahead, do your thing. Yeah? For us as an organization, we only offer a new scholarship after raising 100% of the funds needed to support a student for the entire duration of their high school education. So we make sure we've got all the money in the bank for all 4 years, accounting for inflation, currency fluctuations, put it in the bank, and then go out and look for a young woman to sponsor. And what that enables us to do is to, one, make sure we never break a promise. When we tell you we're giving you a full scholarship for all 4 years, your money is in the bank. It really is. And that's really powerful. The second thing is, should Akilidada fold tomorrow, the money will be in the bank to keep the promises we've made. So it's security and stability for the scholars, and it's security and stability for us as an organization. Scholars are individually paired with professional Kenyan women who volunteer to serve as mentors. So right now, our scholars are interacting with someone from the Akilidada community about once every 2 weeks. We are high touch. If not a professional mentor, an older woman mentor, then it's one of our alumni, high school alumni. We have two layers of mentoring, I should say that. One is the professional women, and the second layer is our alumni. We plow them right back into the organization, using them as mentors. And so that enables us to maintain deep contact with the young women. Our scholars practice leadership by designing and implementing community service projects in their home communities. And this is an important element of our leadership training curriculum. I mentioned that it's experiential. So when we first started, it was based mostly on that community service component and self-reflection. Now we've started leadership training academies where we're combining three elements, where our leadership training curriculum is now three elements. One is the community service. You learn how to lead by doing. You learn how to lead by leading, being out there, looking around in your community, assessing needs, what needs to happen, what needs to change, what can you do about it? And this is a powerful message. When you take a young woman, again, who's coming from a very disadvantaged background, and you tell her, I want you to go home, look around what needs to be done, and I want you to be the one to do something about it. Her thinking shifts. She goes from being poor, woeful me into seeing herself as an agent of change. That's one tremendous, tremendous benefit. A second benefit is you could put me in a village for a month to talk about how important it is to give women opportunities to lead. Or you could have the same village observe one of their very own bring about tremendous social good into the community over and over and over again. And you'll be more effective when you have the young woman who belongs to the community, who's come up from that community, be the shining example. And so we're shifting attitudes, and we're shifting attitudes by having these young women come back and plow back into their communities. So that's a twofold benefit that we have from the service component. So this leadership training curriculum has the service component. We have leadership training academies that we started this year. And what we do with that is bring together all our scholars, all our alumni. This is young women who finished high school, who are either in the gap year or who are in university. Some of the mentors, and then deliver content in a classroom setting, but in a pedagogical style that's different from what they're used to. So instead of lectures, we do a lot of group discussions, right? We do a lot of circle time, a lot of conversations. And what happens is discussing readings that we select. And a lot of what happens is the scholars, the young women, then get to share their coping mechanisms, right? These are young women who are coming from very difficult and very stressed out backgrounds. They need to learn how to survive. And they need to learn how to survive and cope in the high-stress world that we're urging them into. And the best way to do that is to feel like you're part of a group. You've got your posse. You've got your goals with you. And what our leadership academies really help us do is crystallize that community, that sense of community. So the curriculum... The curriculum is experiential learning, the academies, and self-reflection. It is a bad leader that does not stop. Think about where they're coming from, where they're at now, and where they're going. Self-reflection is critical to good leadership. And so a part of what we're doing with our leadership training curriculum is encouraging. First of all, we start by requiring to get a scholarship to stay within the program, you have to do this, this, and this. After 4 years of being part of the organization and part of the work that we're doing, it's second nature. It's habit. It's what you do on a regular basis. And so part of what we do is this self-reflection exercises, a set of guiding questions that really are designed to help get at who are you? Where are you on this journey? What are you trying to improve about yourself? What can we bring into your life to help you do that? And it's personal goal setting, right? There's nothing quite as powerful as a goal that you have articulated. Because then you start to hold yourself to it. Once you've put it down, once you've said it, once you've named it, something shifts and you start to hold yourself accountable to it. And that's what we're building up in the young women that we work with. Okay. I talked about the self-assessment exercises. These are to help the young women remain in touch with their own selves, their own needs, and to start to discern their own personal leadership style. Because that's something you've got to figure out for yourself. What's your style? Some people, like me, talk a mile a minute. Other people are the quiet type. Both can be very effective, efficient leaders. But you will do best if you're in a style that works for you. We have a fellows program that I've alluded to where we offer high school alumni an opportunity to come back into Akilidada. They intern in our office. They're part of the staff. They become part of the staff. And if not with us, if we've got too many, then we send them off to partner organizations. Or if a young woman really has a passion for art, we'll send her to an artist to do her internship there. If you've got a real passion for whatever, we'll identify a way that you can start to build your professional resume in that field. So that's another component. And I also mentioned this. By serving as mentors to current scholars, our high school alumni form an additional layer of support to the scholars while themselves learning valuable leadership skills. So you used to be in school and people would come and mentor you. You now get to go be in school and serve as a mentor. And it really starts to demystify this idea of mentoring. Because right now, and this is an ongoing conversation within the organization, right? Like, what is a mentor? What is the role of a mentor? And what are the power dynamics in that mentoring relationship? And so yes, we have a mentoring program, but it is one we continue to ask questions about as we work on improving. And hopefully some of that can come up in the Q&A. We also have mentor-only events where we're trying to build up the community of mentors themselves. One of the things that started quite by accident is a community of mentors where there's a cadre of professional women who actually need to be in community, need to connect with each other and talk with each other about the career state challenges or life challenges that they're having. And so that started off as a side project, but as we've started to see how important it is to actually bring it into the mainstream of what we do as an organization. If we're saying we're a leadership incubator for women, then working with women who are in their past their educational phase of their lives is also important. And again, these are some other conversations we're starting to have internally about what does mentoring do or mean. Impact, so far we've invested in about 187 young women leaders between the age of 13 and to 24. What that number doesn't tell you is how deep the transformation that these young women have gone through is, right? So of this 187, 67 have been direct scholarship recipients, or will be by the end of this year. We're going to add 30 new scholarship recipients this year. One of the ways that we have grown is through Akili Dada clubs in the partner schools where we work. We don't run a school. We offer scholarships to young women who've been accepted to some of the top schools in the country. We realized that we wanted to build out our presence in these schools, and that what we were delivering in terms of content and leadership training would have value beyond the young women who we fund directly. So one of the big areas we're growing, especially this year, is reaching out to other young women in the schools who benefit from the other parts of our program outside of the scholarships, right? So 100% of our scholarship recipients have earned full scholarships to universities around the world, including the Ivy League. So these are young women who are really at the top of their game. This is a rough estimate. Over 10,000 people in urban and rural poor communities are benefiting from the multiple community service projects conducted by our young women leaders. Because when you go home and you're working at the local clinic or you do the tree planting, you run the tree planting project for you in your local community, those benefits translate into members of that community. So, I mean, that's a really hard number to talk about. This is a specific exact number. But we can talk about that too. We've done really well building a diverse, intergenerational, and international movement of women who really continue to excellence in lifelong learning while paying it forward. The idea of Akili Dada, the community, especially a community of women, both in the Bay Area and in Kenya, that we have built around this idea of supporting other young women has been tremendous. And that's important to me because so often we have conversations about, you might have heard this said, oh, women are their own worst enemies. You know, women just don't collaborate well with each other. Well, we at Akili Dada are a living testament to that's just not true. And I'm really proud that we've been able to do that. We are starting to see the improved family outcomes of our scholarship recipients whose families have been living in poverty. We're starting to see families, because we've paid the school fees for all 4 years, families are starting to invest in other things that are helping them rise up out of poverty. That was not, I have to be honest, when I started this organization, that was not something I was thinking about. But it's been really wonderful to see when I'm talking with one of our scholars and she says, you know, my mom finally went back to school and she's finishing up that qualification and she's going to be able to earn more money. And someone else saying, you know, my family finally moved out of the slum. And I think that's really cool. And it wasn't my brilliant idea, that's for sure. We've had a good run of it. We've had wonderful recognition. Earlier this year, we were at the White House, recognized as a champion of change. We've won the United Nations Marketplace of Idea competition in 2010. The Yamashita Prize from UC Berkeley was really tremendous last year. And the Howe Fellowship from the Howe Fund, which invests in young women, in organizations that are supporting young women, has been tremendous to be honored with that, as well as the African International Achievers Award for organizations that are really helping achieve the MDGs. So I think I'm going to stop there. That's our 2012 budget. Kind of show the insides a little bit, lift the cloak. $420,000 this year. 80% of it is going towards programs. 16% towards administration. We can have a conversation about, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Because I think we can talk. What does it cost to make these scholarship investments that we're doing? It costs us $6,000 to take a young woman to school for all 4 years, and we're sending her to the best schools in the country, and we're paying for everything. Every single thing. School fees, PTA fees. She will walk out of school with her diploma and no debt. For $6,000, that's not bad. So I'm going to stop here, and hopefully we can move into a Q&A.
Thank you, Wantaru. We're going to set up. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is the program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Professor Wantaru Kamau-Rutenberg on her work investing in the development of vulnerable girls in Africa. And we'll now take questions from the audience. Please use the microphone.
Wonderful idea. Thank you so much. 187 girls, how did you choose them? From how many villages? And were they already in primary school, or did you just select children at a very younger age?
Let me take the questions one at a time, because I'll forget who asked what. We have a model. We've built a model that's built to fit hand in glove with the Kenyan education system. And I say that for those of us listening who would be interested in replicating what we're doing, which part of the conversation was on how do you replicate and scale this kind of work. You have got to be very conscious to fit the work to the system that exists and to not be bringing in something foreign that does not translate into local realities. So what we've done in Kenya is, Kenya has a ranking system for high schools. At the end of eighth grade, every single student takes a standardized exam, similar to the SAT. And based on those scores, students get selected into variously ranked high schools. What we've done is, and the high schools are forced, the top high tier high schools are forced by government to use a quota system so that they are picking the two top students from every single county in the country. So that's the government's way of making sure there's some attempt at equality, right? Because otherwise you will have the city kids who've been spoon-fed for all 8 years really will not be at par with the students who went to school one day a week under a tree in a really difficult situation. Yet, if you threw the same investments into both children, they'd probably perform just as well as each other. So that's what the government does with the top-tier schools. They say, we're going to make sure that all the top students from across the country get a fair chance to excel. And so all the top tier schools have to pick from across the country. What we've done that I think is really innovative is go to the top schools and say to them, you have amongst your students a sample of the whole country. Instead of us trying to stretch our resources to travel to every single corner of the country, we're going to come to you and we're going to ask you, Which students would you identify as fitting our model, because you know us? Who would you recommend? And they give us a short list. Now, that's really clever, because we've now gotten the schools invested in what we're doing. We're not working against each other. They gave us who they want to keep at the school. They need the money for school fees. They want to keep this girl here. She's brilliant. She's going to help them maintain their top status as a top national school. And so we're working together now to make sure this young woman succeeds. So that eliminates a significant source of conflict. So from that shortlist, we then have our own internal processes. First stop, we tell our alumni, come back, read through these young women who are shortlisted, then apply. And we've got our application form. We then tell our alumni, come back and help us select the next cohort. And this is a very clever way of plowing them back into the organization and getting them invested in who is going to be joining the community. So they make their first cut, and they have to do it in consensus. It's not an up or down vote. You have all got to agree. And then from that list, this takes so much time, as you can now imagine, right? It's really labor intensive. From that list, we then bring in other stakeholders, staff, board members, mentors, advisory council members, some of our funding partners, to sit in round tables and interview the finalists. And each interview is at least an hour long. And there's at least four of us interviewing you. So if you walked in with some kind of story that your mom told you to say, it's going to fall apart within that 1 hour, because it's four very smart people picking at it. And you get, and it's a diversity of people, because every once in a while, I've been doing these for a couple of years, and every once in a while, you know, one of my colleagues will pick something up, and I'm like, really? You got that from that answer? And she'll be like, yeah, did you, and connect the dots. So this other, you know, this, but she had said this and this and this before. One of the things is HIV status of the family, because that is a big impact on a family's ability to pay for this young woman. Frequently, the parents will not reveal their status to the children, right? Because you don't want to stress this child out. But at the same time, you've got to try and understand what's going on with this family. And could this be, so there's key words that have over time come up, you know, oh, long illness, cancer, then you dig more. But it's a process that we've refined over time to really get at what's going on in this family. And then the other thing is, it's how you identify this, that this is a young woman who's passionate about social change. Right? Because one thing we say is, we're not picking you for what you don't have. We're not picking you because you're poor and you don't have money. We're picking you for what you do have. You've got the smarts, you've got the resilience, and you've got the passion, and you have been serving your community already. So a lot of these young women, all of these young women, are entering their Kilidada community because they were the 13-year-old that mobilized their whole church youth group to go plant trees. She was the young woman who mobilized all the young people around her to go do a community cleanup event. This is a young woman who's already showing an acumen to doing, to mobilizing, to organizing. She's got a bird's eye view of her community, and she wants to bring about change. And what we want to do is magnify her capacity to be able to do that. Because if she's doing that at 13, ooh, watch out, by the time she's 50. I mean, she will just be, woo! And that's a goal. That's where we're headed.
How many scholarship recipients have graduated from high school, and what are they doing now?
We have had 16 graduate from high school, and every single one of them has gotten a full scholarship to university. Really interesting story. One of them, 16 have graduated from university, from high school. All of them have gotten accepted into universities. We've got one young woman at UPenn. Sorry, I confuse UPenn and Penn State. It's UPenn. And we've got a young woman at Vassar. And those are our two, and both are on full rides. Man, the Ivy League one was like $60,000 a year. Pop. I'm just saying, we put in a total of $6,000 over 4 years. And this young woman has turned around and turned it into $60,000 a year. You show me what you're investing in that's bringing in that kind of return. It's just a good deal. I mean, if you're just thinking return on investment, it's amazing. What's really interesting, a little story I wanna tell is this year, two young women got full scholarships to an American university, and both of them turned it down and opted to stay at Kenyan universities that they had gotten accepted to. To me, that's a success story, because one of the issues that we thought about when we were starting was brain drain. Are we going to create an organization that funnels the best and brightest minds out of the continent? And so for me to get to a place where we have exposed this young woman to enough successful women in her local context that she's like, I could make it here or I could make it there. I think I'm going to do this. And it's not like they're picking corn at home. Nothing wrong with picking corn. One of them is in medical school and the other one is starting architecture school this month. So, I mean, they are going to do great. And I'm so excited for them. And so for me, it's about choice. Can we get to a place where we present African women with choice and trust them that they will decide what is important to them and what they want to have happen in their lives? So I'm really excited for that.
Hi. I spent a few years in Peace Corps in Uganda, and I don't know the cultural context in Kenya, but I know in Uganda I would observe a lot of the young women spending a lot of time fetching water, cooking, cleaning, caring for their kids, caring for their siblings, caring for neighborhood children, et cetera. And I'm just curious how this program takes into account the cultural context of these young women who are doing projects in communities where it sounds like there might be some gender inequality. And I'm just curious, not just in the community service projects, but in general in your program, how you address sort of that cultural context and that challenge.
That's a great question. All of the young women we're working with, because we have selected and chosen to work with young women from underprivileged backgrounds, every single one of them is dealing with something like that. Whether it's in a village context, a rural context, in the context of rural poverty or urban poverty. For example, one of the young women who's from a slum in Nairobi had to deal daily with the threat of rape, being raped on the way in and out from school and back, going to the toilet at night. So every single one of these young women is dealing with something incredibly difficult. What we're really focused on is coping skills and building resilience. Because at the end of the day, Akili Dada is not going to be able to address the issue of child labor or domestic labor. They will. These young women will. And so what we need to do is help them have the skills to analyze what's going on in their homes, in their communities, in their backgrounds, and what do they want to do to change. Because ultimate power to change these situations is in their hands. And that's how we're dealing with those challenges, is we want you to be able to cope and be resilient, to live through it. And then when you're done living through it, we want you to be the person who comes back and changes it. And sometimes it's not so much a going away to come back. Sometimes you're best able to address the challenge if you never leave in the first place. So one of the things we're really conscious about is you've got to do service in your community. You don't go to the other community, because that necessitates a cutting off. Right? When you start to other, there's a separation, and then you fail to be able to analyze power relations, power dynamics that you're embedded in. We want you to bring change in your community, and then we leave it open. How do you define your community? And it's so interesting, because some of them consider their physical community. Others are more embedded in their school community, and that's where they want to serve. Others are their church community. We leave it open, so long as you're thinking about it. And we ask you, how are you defining your community? So this is your project. How did you define your community? So that you think about it. Like, it is an active thing to build community. And it is something that you have to think about. And then we leave it open to what that service looks like. But what we do is we ask you, why did you think that this was the best way to serve? Tell us about your thought process. Again, we care a lot less about what they actually do, but we care a lot more about their ability to think things through and be intentional in their leadership actions.
From what you said, it sounds like now Rwanda is one of the very best African countries in having women in leadership positions. And it sounds like maybe Kenya is one of the worst in proportion or in numbers, in percentages. Well, can you mention a few other African countries which are particularly good at a number, high proportion of women in leadership, and some that are the weakest?
That's a minefield. It's a great question, but I'm gonna need to be delicate about walking around that one. Let me tell you why. What I showed here was political representation. Remember, we are very firm on political representation is only one element of leadership. If this country, if the U.S., dependent only on its political leadership to get stuff done, just saying. It's not like Congress has been getting along really well and getting stuff done really quickly, right? So we have to move outside of this mold of looking at political participation as the only form or even the main form of leadership. Someone like Wangari Maathai did incredible Nobel Prize winning, first African woman to win a Nobel Prize. She did tremendous, tremendous social change work outside of elected office. And in fact, some may argue when she did step into elected office, she was hampered because that wasn't her particular skill and style. And so what I would want to urge is for us to adopt a much broader view of what leadership is, both for men and women. Because once we do, and once we move from that pyramid where we put political participation at the top, then we start to see all sorts of incredible, amazing social change makers amidst us. And we should be doing all we can to invest in them. So I didn't quite answer your question, but I'm intentionally not ranking countries.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation, a wonderful program. Last year I was in Tanzania working with a NGO that helps girls that have been sold and prostituted and enslaved. And, you know, it's sort of generally accepted that if you help women and girls rise up, you are helping future generations. They had started a program, I think it was called Champion, to help work with men, which I've always sort of thought of as throwing money down the drain. But they were saying that they were seeing a shift in international funding away from women and girls to men. Have you seen this? What are your thoughts on working with men versus women and girls in terms of development?
I have so many thoughts, so many opinions. I shall try to stop myself from rambling for too long. First of all, I'm a feminist. I am a feminist mother of a little 3-year-old boy and a feminist wife to a man, right? We're not going to be getting rid of men. We might as well figure out how we're going to live with them and how we're going to raise them. I'm sure some of my team in the room are cringing at some of the stuff I'm saying.
You're raising, of course,
yes.
Women and girls are the target, and that you are raising.
Yes. We have got to work across the board, right? We have got to work across the board. We cannot ignore young men, right? We have got to have holistic solutions to society's problems. We have got to do that. Now, that said, my particular passion in Akili Dada's particular work is working with women. And we work in partnership and in support of organizations that are doing a similar, that are focused on similar end goals, but working with men. We've got to have those integrated solutions. One of my favorite quotes is by Wangari Maathai, who said something like, "We want to focus so much on poor, miserable African women, but poor, miserable African women are often married to poor, miserable African men." You're not going to be able to touch and isolate girls from their fathers, their brothers, their uncles, their cousins, right? So when it comes to analysis, we cannot move men from the picture. But we also have to be strategic, right? And so for us as an organization, our strategy is to work with young women, even as we envision a society that is fully equal. Because some of the challenges, all of the challenges that the young women we're raising up to address, need to address, whether it's environment, whether it's economic crisis, all of these challenges affect men and women. So it's really important to have that holistic analysis and then get strategic about where are you best leveraged. Right? Like, where do you have the skills and the ability to really bring the maximum support? And then build alliances in the spaces where you're not working. And to me, that's actually good feminism. So that's how I reconcile all those spots, all those varying. Now, in terms of funding, I personally am not seeing an overwhelming diversion or growth of funds towards men rather than women. What I am seeing is, on one hand, a backlash against the rhetoric that we have had emerging, that girls and women are the only important members of society that we should be investing in. So, actually, I'm doing a bad job of that. Let me back up a little bit. Right now, and this was one of the notes that I wanted to talk about, right now, we're in an environment where there's overwhelming discourse on investing in women and girls, right? Like, from Nike Foundation with the Girl Effect to, I mean, everybody. The Clinton Global Initiative has been focusing a lot. Everyone has discovered women and girls. And all of a sudden, we have decided that the way we're going to solve all the world's problems is throw money at women and girls. I actually find that problematic. And I'm saying that as someone who's running what? A leadership incubator that works with girls. The reason I find that problematic is there's two pitfalls of this approach. One, we have started to create a backlash in some of our societies where men and boys feel like they're an endangered species, where men and boys feel like they don't matter. And that's a problem because it further makes girls and women less safe in their families and in their communities. Right? And this is a discourse issue. It's not a funding issue. It's a discourse issue. How we talk about women and girls and why we're doing what we're doing is important because it shapes fights and struggles that I then go to have in Kenya with my community in Kenya. And it makes my life difficult when all Kenyans have been hearing is Americans just care about women and girls and they don't care about men and holistic solutions. Okay? So that's one pitfall. The other pitfall is we have gotten so wrapped up in investing in women and girls for what we can get out of them. So we have started to use women and girls as pawns in a larger development agenda. So the reason we want to invest in women and girls is because they are going to have less kids. The reason we want to invest in women and girls is because they're going to bring about food security. The reason to invest in women and girls is because, you know, they are going to address issues of resource depletion, because they are the drivers of economic engines. We have stopped talking about the importance of investing in women and girls as a rights issue. We have to invest in women and girls because it's the right thing to do. It is the fair thing to do. It is the just thing to do. Not just because we want them to then turn around and become better workers or better, you know, better this, that, or the other, or whatever else we need, right? So the issue, and it comes down to autonomy. Because any time I, as an African woman, get talked about as a tool or a pawn in somebody else's larger project, what gets erased is my autonomy, my ability and right to make decisions about my life. So what happens if these women and girls we invest in because we want them to go grow more corn don't grow more corn because whatever reason? Do we then stop those investments? Right? So those are the pitfalls of some of the hype around this. And I think if we're not careful, we can cause more harm than good. If we're not thoughtful, if we're not intentional. Now, I'm saying all this, again, as the director of an organization that invests in women and girls. So it's actually a point of how matters. Like, one of my friends has this wonderful blog, How Matters. How you do something matters. The reasoning behind why you're doing what you're doing matters, because it shapes outcomes at the very end. So that was a really good question, because it gave me a chance to get some of that out.
Just a few years back, I finished a year in South Sudan, your neighbor in East Africa, with Valentino Achekdeng's secondary school up in South Sudan. And the goal there is to try to have a 50% female population in the school. They're quite a ways from it, but that's the goal. We had about 10% at the time, and they were generally extraordinarily qualified girls and everything. But the challenge there in that culture, with the Dinka culture, was that the families had not always understood what was being expected of them as well as their daughters. And what happened is sometimes girls were married off by their fathers, i.e. they were sold for cattle, and just yanked out of secondary school without anybody's prior knowledge. And I just wonder to what extent you involve the families in your discussions early on as to what their obligations are. Because you are taking on a certain burden here?
That's a great question. I want to answer that in two parts. The first, more direct answer is the young women have to apply, right? Like, so you've got to actually submit an application, which is an act or it's an active thing, right? We don't just tell you, we're going to pick you. No, you have to apply to us. You have to come for the interview. And so it's something, it respects the agency of the young women in making that decision. The first thing we do after we have accepted a young woman is pay for a member of her family to come to Nairobi, meet with us, see our office, meet with our staff, and get oriented to what Akilidada is all about. We didn't always do that, and that was not helpful. So we actually now have an orientation, and then a three-way contract. Actually, it's four ways. We sign, the scholar signs, a member of her family signs, and the school signs. So we're balancing very complex relationships. The joy and beauty of it is we all want the same thing. We all want this young woman to succeed. So that's the logistical part of it. The culture side of it. I think we've gotten into a very dichotomous conversation about culture versus rationality, right? Like, oh, if this family took the girl to school or whatever, why aren't families taking girls to schools? To school, and it's irrational for families not to take girls to school. And what I want to point out is the absolute rationality of why poor families choose not to take their girls to school. What is the wage difference in America? How much money does a man make versus a woman for the same work? Right? Men make 30% more. In this society that has all sorts of regulations and blah, blah, blah. That is so, that disparity is so much higher in resource insecure societies. And the stakes are so much higher if you call it wrong. If you call that wrong, you could end up with, I mean, I'm just going to assume, because we don't have statistics on this. I'm just going to assume at best 50, right? So a woman will make 50 cents to a dollar in a poorer, more unequal society. Why in the world would any family, when they only have limited resources to take one child to school, and you've got two to pick from, why would you pick the one who's going to end up making the lower wage? It is a completely rational decision to say, well, the boy is going to make more money at the end of this, and she's going to be able to support us more. So it's not a thing of culture is not rational, right? It's those cultural beliefs, even though they're coded as culture, are actually very rational decisions of people who are calculating both short-term costs and long-term potential. So it's actually really quite clever. The challenge for us, though, is how do we mitigate that? So one of the things that we keep needing to convince donors about is the importance of scholarships. Our leadership training program is so sexy, and people love it. Love it. The scholarships, you pay school fees, she goes to school, yeah, great. And then there's the, oh, but for the 6,000, we could send 60 girls to school. Yeah, they're going to sit in a classroom with like barely four walls and not learning anything. So these are some of the ways that Akilidada has chosen very intentionally to mitigate some of these challenges is, one, you erase the burden, the financial burden, through a scholarship. And then the family doesn't have to choose between the son or the daughter, because we're going to pay for everything. Once you level that financial playing field, I have got some fathers that are all over us. They love us. They love what we're doing. They are engaged. And their moms are right there with the kids too. Once you level that financial playing field. And there's nothing as tremendous as a father who has got her daughter's back. Oh, it's powerful. It is powerful. But we've got to step away from this untrue dichotomy.
We have time for one quick question, and then we'll wrap up.
I was wondering about the situation of the ordinary Kenyan girls in of that age group, and you've touched on this a bit, but not so much your outstanding scholars, but do most of them even go to high school? What does it cost? Does the government pay for some?
The general context within which we're operating is there's free primary school education, and of that, girls are actually 50% of primary school students, which shows us when the cost imperative is removed, parents take their girls to school. Okay, so there goes that cultural argument. This is in Kenya, okay? Now, secondary school, we're at 30%. Girls are, is it 30? It's higher. What is it exactly? Girls are up to 48%. You know what's really amazing about why it used to be 30% up until we just got the new statistics. That's why I'm looking at my colleague. Up to 48%. It used to be 30%. You know what has happened? 3 years ago, the Kenyan government, no, what is this, 2007, 2008, in 2008, what was that, 4 years? Oh my God, that's exactly why. High school is 4 years in Kenya. Sorry, I hadn't made that correlation before. 4 years ago, the Kenya government said, we're going to start giving every single high school student, we're going to start funding a minimal amount for every high school student. So it's not free, but it's subsidized. So it's about 10,000 shillings per student per year. An average school, I want to say, costs about 30 to 40,000 per year. So about a third of the cost is subsidized. It's correlation, but I'm just saying that's a pretty strong correlation. And I'm just waiting for someone really, really smart to go ahead and do the study, because then I can say it with confidence. But, I mean, it's striking. Again, going back to that issue of, once you do the financials, the culture issue falls through. So that now, where we've got big problems is, first of all, quality of the education, and this is a policy issue. We have got to improve the quality of education. And this is just a little sidebar. We've been so focused on getting girls to school and into classrooms. What the heck is happening when they sit there? We haven't had the conversation about, are they learning? Or are we just taking them away from the field to park them in a room? Right? So that, I mean, this whole conversation about investing and educating girls, we need to get more substance into it. What are they learning when they get there? What is their actual benefit from sitting in a room? What's the content? So that's one thing. I lost my train of thought. At the tertiary level, we still have gaps. And that's, again, going to be a policy issue. And please note, Akili Dada works at the high school level, and that's very intentional. There's huge shifts that happen in young women on that cusp from girlhood to young womanhood. And if we figure if you can speak into the life of a young woman during that transition, you have massive impact in her ability to continue on.
Great. Let's thank our speaker. Thank you, Ranjiru, for your stimulating conversation and the work you do. Also, I want to thank the members of our audience and the co-sponsors, which include the University of San Francisco, Akili Dada, of course, the Priority Africa Network, the UN Association, the Truman National Security Project, and the NorCal Peace Corps Association. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.